From the City of Angels off the Pacific Ocean, good morning, good evening, wherever you may be, across the nation, around the world. I'm George Norrie, and welcome to the world's most listened to late night talk show, Coast to Coast AM, floating format tonight. Our main guests will start this hour, and we'll devote the last hour to open lines. A bizarre story, simply incredible, out of Arizona. Officers responding to a report of an exorcism on a young girl, found her grandfather choking her. They used stun guns to subdue him. He later died. The three-year-old girl and her mother, who was also in the room during the struggle, were hospitalized. The relative who called police said an exorcism had been attempted. The purpose was to release demons from this very young girl, said a sergeant of the police department. Officers arrived at the house, entered when they heard screaming coming from a bedroom. A bed had been pushed up against the door. The officers pushed it open a few inches, saw the man choking his bloodied granddaughter, who was crying in pain and gasping for air. About a week ago, a Canadian National freight train changed crews at Carbondale, Illinois. I'm very familiar with that. It's not too far from St. Louis. And then they proceeded on its northbound journey. Around 5 o'clock in the morning, the two-man crew spotted a male lying across the track near Main Street in Dowell, Illinois. It's a small town between Carbondale and DuCoyne, right on the tracks. They knew there was going to be an emergency. The crew started, you know, doing what they could do. They were honking. They were hitting that emergency button. Nothing. The person sat up, looked at them, and just before their train hit him, they had no time. When stopped, the crew called 911, and they also called, of course, the Canadian National Freight Train Company. Within minutes, county sheriff's police showed up. The Perry County Sheriff's Police showed up. An emergency services crew showed up. And also, I'm told, the Canadian National Freight Train Company showed up. After a four-hour search, no clothing, blood, body was found. The crew demanded the search be continued, telling the police they were 100% sure they hit a man. But the personnel told the police that engineers often think they hit a person, and they think maybe they really did not. The search ended. Later that day, the editor of the Steelville Ledger, which is a small newspaper out that way, began an investigation into this incident. And after days of searching and a further investigation, checking old copies of an older newspaper, he discovered an obituary notice that said a man was hit and killed at the same spot in 1941, with the engineer stating the exact circumstances. A bizarre ghost story, perhaps. The widely used diabetes drug Avendia should be pulled from the market because of heart risks, according to a federal scientist. Those risks, combined with no unique short-term benefits in helping diabetics control blood sugar levels, fail to justify keeping this drug on the market, according to a scientist with the Food and Drug Administration, Dr. David Graham. Glaxo, the maker of the drug, however, disputes the claim. Now, here we go again in China. Now, in the latest of a long line of scares over imports from China, the Food and Drug Administration and the California Department of Public Health, they're warning you not to eat fresh ginger from China. They say certain batches commonly used in Chinese and Japanese dishes were found to be contaminated with traces of a hazardous pesticide. This pesticide can cause us to be poisoned within the first hour of exposure. Now, if you don't ingest a lot of it, you'll get flu-like symptoms. If you eat a lot of it, it can really get to you. The ginger has been found in Albertson stores and Save Mart stores in Northern California. One of Michael Vick's co-defendants pleaded guilty to dogfighting charges in Richmond Federal Court in Virginia. In a plea agreement with prosecutors, a 34-year-old Tony Taylor entered his plea in the U.S. District Court to conspiracy to travel in interstate commerce in aid of unlawful activities and conspiring to sponsor a dog in an animal fighting venture. He also agreed to cooperate with federal prosecutors. In California, Al Gore's son has pleaded guilty to possessing marijuana and other drugs, but a judge said the plea could be withdrawn and the charges dropped if he successfully completes a drug diversion program. Authorities have said that they found drugs in Al Gore III's car after the 24-year-old was pulled over on the 4th of July for going 100 miles an hour in his car. Supreme Court Justice John Rhodes has recovered, but there were some tense moments. He had a seizure, was taken to the hospital where he is spending the night now. He fell after the seizure, and they say he has fully recovered. Tom Snyder, whose smoke-filled interviews were a staple of late-night television and an inspiration for Dan Aykroyd on Saturday Night Live, has died after a struggle with leukemia. He was 71 years old. Snyder died Sunday in San Francisco from complications associated with leukemia. Known for his improvised, very casual style and his robust laughter, Snyder conducted a number of memorable interviews as host of NBC's Tomorrow Show. Among some of his guests, John Lennon and Charles Manson.
Let's go back to 1967, the time you were winding up serving a term of number of years, 10 years. And written accounts indicate that you told the authorities, "Don't let me out. I can't cope with the outside world." Do you have a recollection of that?
And desperate plea out of something, man. There's no desperate plea out of it. I say I can't handle the maniacs outside. Let me back in.
I didn't use the word desperate. That's your word, Charles.
Yeah, well, your inflection and your voice tones were implications there.
Snyder began his career as a radio reporter in Milwaukee in the 60s. He moved into local television news. He anchored newscasts in Philadelphia and Los Angeles before moving to late-night television. Tom Snyder, dead at the age of 71. Bill Walsh, the groundbreaking football coach who won 3 Super Bowls and perfected the very ingenious schemes that became known as the West Coast offense during a Hall of Fame career with the San Francisco 49ers, has died. He, 75, he died following a long battle with leukemia as well. In Hamlin, Pennsylvania, they say lightning can strike twice. Just ask Don Frick. He said he survived a second lightning strike on Friday. This is the strange part about all this. 27 years to the day that he got hit with a bolt. 27 years to the day. How strange is that? He was shaken. He had a burned zipper and a hole in the back of his jeans, simply saying, "I'm lucky I'm alive." Strange sightings of a huge flying creature in San Antonio, Texas, reported as recently as 6 months ago. Witnesses saying that they are seeing this huge bird with a mammoth wingspan. We're going to look into this story. Could be the Thunderbirds are back. And in a moment, the brain, hallucinogens, and what's happening with some research. We'll check in with that on Coast to Coast AM. Well, researchers are offering new ammunition to you parents trying to dissuade your teens about smoking marijuana. Evidence is mounting, they say, that for some adolescents whose genes put them at added risk, heavy marijuana use could increase the chances of developing severe mental illness, psychosis, or schizophrenia. Tonight, 2 guests for you as we talk about the brain and psychedelics. First, Charles Grobe, MD type, is the director of the Division of Child and Adolescent Psychiatry at Harbor UCLA Medical Center and professor of psychiatry and pediatrics at the UCLA School of Medicine. He's the editor of Hallucinogens, a reader, and the co-editor with Robert Walsh of Higher Wisdom, Eminent Elders Explore the Continuing Impact of Psychedelics. And he has published numerous articles on psychedelics in medical and psychiatric journals. Charles is also a founding member of the Hefter Research Institute, which is now devoting itself to fostering and funding research on psychedelics. Dr. Charles Grobe. Hello, doctor. How are you?
Oh, hello. I'm very well. Thank you, George.
Good to have you with us tonight. And Dr. Marilyn Schlitz, PhD type, is vice president for research and education at the Institute of Noetic Sciences. That's Dr. Mitchell's organization, and senior scientist at the Research Institute at the California Pacific Medical Center. She will be with us tonight as well. Hello, Dr. Schlitz. How are you?
Hello, George. Nice to talk to you again.
Good. How is Dr. Mitchell doing these days?
He's very well. He's staying abreast of all the fascinating things that are happening in the world right now. I just talked to him yesterday, and he seems to be very, very well.
Good. We're working on getting him on for a complete show.
Excellent.
to those people who do not know who Dr. Mitchell is, Dr. Edgar Mitchell, Apollo 14, one of the astronauts who walked on the moon. Now, with both of you, I'm just going to open this up as we talk for the next couple hours about this. With you, Dr. Grobe, tell us a little bit about how you got involved in basically researching hallucinogens as medicine.
Well, I mean, this is an area that was actually at some time ago in the 50s and early mid-60s was one of the leading cutting-edge research areas in psychiatry. And it was only after the cultural turmoil of the late 60s that that this area was abandoned. When I decided to go to medical school and become a physician and then become a psychiatrist, I had an opportunity to read much of the old literature, and I was very impressed with the as yet untapped potentials this research model held for understanding the brain, the mind-brain interface, understanding mental illness, and perhaps giving us some new paths to explore, new and innovative treatment models.
And Dr. Schlitz, your involvement and interest.
Well, the Institute of Noetic Sciences has long been interested in consciousness and understanding the potentials of our consciousness. And one of the things that we have been particularly tracking is the way in which people hold models of reality. And so there are many triggers that can open us to a broader sense of reality. And one of those triggers is psychedelics. Another is, you know, a trip to the moon like Edgar Mitchell. In each case, I think what's revealed is that there are a broader set of possibilities. The kind of work that Dr. Grobe is doing, I think, reveals the potentials of using something like psilocybin, you know, the magic mushroom.
Magic mushroom, sure.
As a way of really working with terminally ill patients who are hungry for a more expanded meaning system and really looking for quality of life at the end of life. And so I see that, you know, it's about expanding our model of reality as well as providing therapeutic tools that will help people when they're facing life-threatening situations.
But you're not advocating that people go to their nearest forest and dig up these magic mushrooms if they can find them and gobble them up, are you?
No, absolutely not. I think most of the teachers that we've worked with who have done research on psychedelics, on hallucinogens, advocate that it should be done under very well-controlled circumstances with, you know, somebody trained to guide you. It's not recreational. It's ceremonial. And it does have a really profound sort of spiritual or even religious potential to help, you know, inspire a broader sense of what our human possibility is.
Well, you know, almost since the beginning of mankind, shamans, Dr. Grobe and Dr. Schlitz, shamans have used these hallucinogens in different forms, magic mushrooms, of course, to truly do incredible things with the mind. I mean, they have been able to travel out of their bodies, heal people, and we're talking about events that are thousands of years old.
Well, right, absolutely. I mean, these are the ancient models of healing. These were the ancient medicine men and women who were able to tap into the innate healing potentialities of many plants. And I think there's much to be learned. Unfortunately, with the with the rapid disappearance of indigenous pre-industrial shamanic societies, much of this knowledge is no longer accessible. But to the degree that we have acquired information, clearly these ancients, these so-called primitives, who are not so primitive at all, have much to teach us.
How did they get so advanced? I mean, you're right. They do teach us. When we look at how the Mayans were able to develop their calendars and astronomy, I mean, we all sit back going, how did they know this so long ago? In this particular case, with the use of hallucinogens as medicine and as mood and mind altering, how did they know these? And we're just starting to find out.
Oh, we're just starting to scratch the surface. Keep in mind that the ancient peoples had opportunity to systematically methodically explore the range of effects of hallucinogens, you know, from generation to generation to generation, going on for the anthropologists tell us for tens of thousands of years. And here we're just rediscovering that these substances even exist at all. In fact, it wasn't until the second half of the 20th century that we became even aware that plant hallucinogens like the hallucinogenic mushroom was a real phenomenon instead of mythological.
Because some of these hallucinogens are considered illegal by our government, is that one of the reasons why science has decided in those days really not to look into it, not to investigate this?
Well, I think there's, of course, the legality has made it very problematic in terms of opening this up for investigation, but you know, I think there was a tendency in our culture to disparage any knowledge or information systems derived from the indigenous peoples. So I think it's only at the point at which we have evolved as a culture that we begin to appreciate the exquisite sensitivity that the that native peoples did have to understanding these compounds and the states of mind they induced.
Now, Marilyn, these psychedelics, do they induce something in the brain that might not ever get induced, or is it possible that we human beings can perform these incredible feats without the use of hallucinogens?
Well, it certainly stimulates certain kind of neurochemicals in the brain that our brain naturally produces, but can provide sort of a more intense connection to those states of consciousness. I wanted to go back to your question about indigenous peoples and say that not only is this in the past that people who live, you know, in nature have utilized these practices, you know, through trial and error over thousands of years, as Dr. Grobe mentioned, but I've had the privilege over the last 10 years to work with the Achuar people of the Ecuadorian Amazon. And that's a group that use plant medicines, as they are known, as well as using their nighttime sleeping practices to gain information about realms of reality that mm-hmm. aren't always available during kind of our mundane experiences. So they do something called a collective dreaming practice, where every morning, kind of pre-dawn, they wake up and they believe that it's their responsibility to share the content of their dreams with one another. And the reason for this is that they believe that the soul or the non-tangible aspects of our experience leave the body during sleep and travel through the forest and into the spirit realm. And just in the same way that we might wake up in the morning and read a newspaper to find out what's been happening in the world, they actually believe that the soul goes out, gains reliable information about the future, and then they come back with the notion that nobody gets the whole story, but that each of them has a piece of it. So by doing this dream sharing, they believe that they get reliable information about what to do today and what to do tomorrow. For example, will they be visited? Will the visitors be friendly? Should they hunt? Will the hunt be successful? But if they want a big dream, if they want to know something long-term in the future, they'll make use of different kinds of plant medicines. For example, ayahuasca, which is a hallucinogen that evokes visions.
Right.
And they use these visions as a way of predicting what will happen, you know, a long time in the future. So it's as though they live in a very different kind of worldview, and both in terms of their dream state as well as in this kind of non-ordinary consciousness coming from these hallucinogens or plant medicines, they're able in their cosmology to really, you know, understand aspects of what will come that aren't available to them during their normal waking experience. And I think there's just some really important insights that come from, you know, several aspects of that. One is honoring their inner experience, that dream experience, that visionary experience, honoring it for what it has to tell them about their lives. It also says something about, you know, the need to preserve this kind of knowledge and experience You know, our dominant culture is kind of like a steamroller, and it wants to eradicate or eliminate, you know, get rid of all of these kind of supernatural beliefs. And yet, it seems really important if we want to understand consciousness and our human potential, you know, to really value the insights that come from these traditional societies.
All right, Marilyn, stay with us. You as well, Dr. Grobe. I'm George Norrie. We'll be back in just a moment as we talk. We're going to get into how this affects the brain and the incredible powers of the brain. This is Coast to Coast AM. Oh, when you hear the phrase Philadelphia Experiment, you think of Al Bielek, because Al is the person who truly brought that story to us. A long time ago, Art had an opportunity to interview Al. We've done that several times since, but I want you to hear it because this is an incredible interview.
Because I know enough about future conditions that I'm not quite sure I would want to live 40 years from now.
I'm in sympathy with that view. Well said. Al, it has been a pleasure, my friend. It's been too long. Hopefully we'll get a chance to do it again.
Yes.
I think it's the best interview we've done.
So that was the end of the incredible interview. Now you've got a chance to hear the beginning, because what we're going to do with an After Dark subscription, we're going to give you just nominal shipping and handling fee, that free CD, that Art Bell interview with Al Bielek. And the most important part of all this is we are going to be making a cash donation to Mr. Bielek, who is on hard times. So we're going to provide that to him. So you get the CD for free, and we're able to give Mr. Bielek a donation, which is the first time this company's ever done anything like that. Call 1-888-727-5505, or you can go online and see this and read all about it at coasttocoastam.com. And welcome back to Coast. I'm George Norrie with Dr. Marilyn Schlitz and Dr. Charles Grobe as we talk about the effects of the brain with hallucinogens, psychedelics. Charles, is it science's aim to help cure people with brain disease, with the afflictions, or to make people who have healthy brains do some incredible things?
Well, I think the focus of medicine, by and large, is to try to ameliorate suffering, to try to minimize disabling symptoms, or perhaps cure whatever disorder might be present. In terms of helping the healthy brain to optimize its function, certainly there's interest really on the cutting edge. But in regards to contemporary work with psychedelics, at this point, the work that is finally starting to be approved and begin its efforts, it's mostly focusing on individuals with serious psychiatric disorders or reactive anxiety and depression to medical conditions.
Now, when you talk about serious psychiatric disorders, what are we talking about?
Well, for instance, there's a pilot study at the University of Arizona using psilocybin to treat severe refractory obsessive compulsive disorder. Obsessive compulsive disorder can often be a very disabling condition. It's one of the more difficult to treat, sometimes appearing to be almost impossible to treat, conditions in psychiatry. There was some very promising work done back in the 50s and early 60s. There have been the publications of some anecdotal reports of individuals who self-medicated with psychedelics and found significant relief, and a study led by Dr. Moreno and Dr. Delgado at the University of Arizona is starting to find perhaps some indication that this might be a worthy avenue to pursue further studies.
Is the psilocybin, is it being used in synthetic form, or are they actually extracting it from the magic
mushrooms?
No, this
is entirely synthetic. The same with our study, that this is entirely laboratory synthesized psilocybin. Psilocybin is the active alkaloid found in hallucinogenic mushrooms, and it was through chemical study of mushrooms that psilocybin was first discovered or identified. But for these studies, because of the importance of maintaining consistency and standardization in the compound being administered, it's entirely a synthetic derivative.
You know, back in the 60s, you know, a lot of people use psychedelics and they were frowned on. They were laughed at. They were scoffed. Were those people advanced?
Well, you know, the history of the 60s in this area is a very colorful history. You know, initially, this work with psychedelics were really perceived as the cutting edge, as really really bringing psychiatry to the threshold of some new and very important and valuable discoveries. But then with the cultural wars and turmoil of the later 60s, virtually all work in this area was discounted and shelved aside. I think in many respects, our culture was not ready for the powerful forces that psychedelics could access.
Yeah, Marin, and I'm still fascinated with the interest of the Institute of Noetic Sciences with this, because, you know, knowing Edgar Mitchell and knowing how he is truly fascinated with the ability of the subconscious mind to do incredible things. Is there something you're looking for that we should be aware of? Is there something that you think these hallucinogens might do for people?
Well, in the same way that Edgar Mitchell described his journey home from the historic walk on the moon.
And his experiment, yeah.
It was an experience more than an experiment. I mean, he did an ESP experiment on the moon, which I'm sure he's talked to you about.
Yes.
But this was actually after the official mission on the moon was over, and Edgar's job was to man the little capsule that went from the Apollo capsule to the moon and back. And so, you know, he describes it as, you know, he got to have the window seat on the way home. And looking out at the vastness of space and seeing this amazing planet, the Earth actually rising over the moon, and the enormous implications that he had for his kind of worldview, it really caused him to, you know, feel that there was something about that universe that was his own personal story and that we're all interconnected. And so he had an epiphany and a real enlightenment experience, a noetic experience in that sense of direct knowing. And he combined that with his interest in science and the rigor and discernment that comes from that, and wanted to explore the nature of inner space instead of outer space. What is the nature of inner space? And that seemed important, because when you look at planet Earth and you think about all the major problems we face on a, you know, daily basis, and all you have to do is pick up, you know, any newspaper, and you can hear about the negative stuff. We just heard some of that in terms of you know, whether we should feel optimistic or pessimistic about the future.
Sure. All you got to do is drive in your car, Marilyn, and you'll see the negative stuff.
Exactly. It's there, and we're capable of seeing it. And what Edgar saw in the moment was that consciousness becomes the window into understanding solutions to a lot of these problems. So the Institute, since 1973, has really been about understanding inner space and the potentials that come when we really look internally at what does our consciousness have to say about some of these solutions. And so we're interested in a variety of different doorways in. We have an extensive program in the area of meditation and looking at the science of meditation. We've done a tremendous amount of work in the area of mind-body medicine. We've looked at prayer and healing, including distant intentionality and healing. And to me, in all of these cases, you have amazing experiences, as you have in the case of hallucinogens, that can open people to a different set of possibilities. And so, you know, we're really interested in the science of transformation and how it is that people have these openings.
Okay, where Charles and his group seems very interested in the medical use of these hallucinogens.
I would say it's both in the case of ions. I mean, I think we are fascinated and supportive and excited about what Dr. Grobe is doing, because it does represent a frontier. And there haven't been many people doing research on this topic for a long time. And the fact that he has FDA approval to do this thing in a mainstream medical center and to do it in a way that really speaks to, you know, as he talked about the alleviation, the reduction of human suffering, how do we help people, you know, working with terminally ill patients at the end of life and really trying to use this in a therapeutic way, I think also reveals the transformation. It's all the same. It just depends on at what point you want to wake up.
Well, Dr. Grubb, tell us about the Hefner Research Institute. What is it, and this study, which I believe is probably one of the first of its kind, what do you hope to accomplish here?
Well, sure. Well, the Hector Research Institute is a foundation, not-for-profit foundation, really devoted to getting solid research, medical scientific research with hallucinogens back up and running in reputable medical and scientific institutions. And we've been around. I'm part of the Hefter Institute. We've been around since 1993, and we really are recently getting more success in getting new investigators interested in this area and getting studies funded and approved. In regards to my study, which has been funded by both the Hefter Research Institute and the Elizabeth Gordon Foundation, is a study where we are treating individuals who have advanced stage cancer with associated severe levels of anxiety, existential anxiety, as it were. These are individuals who are with stage 3 or stage 4 cancer, some of whom have very limited life expectancy, and these individuals in this condition often feel very overwhelmed with their circumstance. Often it becomes quite disabling, and even in addition to the physical limitations they might have, emotionally their quality of life has deteriorated. Looking through the literature from the 60s into the early 70s by such prior investigators, most notably Stanislav Grof and the late Walter Pankey, Gary Fisher, Eric Cast. There was some very, very exciting work that was published results were indicating that there may be a role for the judicious application of a hallucinogen treatment session under very well-controlled, sanctioned conditions, that such individuals may have very dramatic alleviations of their anxiety, an improvement of their mood, improvement of their quality of life, not only during the many hours of the actual hallucinogen experience itself, but even in the days, weeks, and even months afterwards. The work of these investigators was very promising, and it really inspired us to develop our protocol and to initiate the process of getting a variety of different regulatory and institutional approvals we needed and getting the funding we needed and to initiate and conduct the study.
Why are you looking at the psilocybin as opposed to just using the conventional drugs that have been used all the time? Do you think you can find something that's better?
Well, by conventional drugs, you mean the standard prescription
medication, yeah.
Well, we feel that there may be, some additive value in exploring this alternative paradigm, this alternative approach. Certainly, standard antidepressants might have some merit in alleviating depression and anxiety conditions. Nevertheless, it's our surmise that the optimally applied hallucinogen model may have a very positive clinical profile in regards to relative risk and relative benefit, allowing individuals to have quite marked lessening of suffering and improved outlook and improved quality of what remaining time they have.
Well, we've seen what some of the mood-altering drugs have done to people and, you know, specific, let's say, some school shootings and things like that. Not everyone has been on these things, but some of them have been in their lives. And who's to say if that had anything to do with their violence?
Well, we're talking about, again, prescription medication.
Yes, yes.
Yeah, well, you know, keep in mind, with all drugs, you know, whether they're standard prescription medications or whether they're the object of investigation and rather limited, all drugs have relative risks and relative benefits, and you really have to weigh one versus the other. We felt reading through the old literature and also perhaps looking at the limitations of our contemporary accepted conventional treatment models that there was a rationale, there was an argument for for reinvestigating this this old and for a long time abandoned area of hallucinogen research and the hallucinogen treatment model.
So I'm confused about the story I had right before both of you came on had to do with increased marijuana use for some people who are genetically inclined, that it could develop psychoses and all kinds of problems with schizophrenia. Yet everything else I've read about the use of marijuana, for example, if you use it for medicinal purposes, has been incredible for some people who can't take pharmaceutical pain pills, for example. Well, I'm confused. On one hand, it's very beneficial. On another, they're saying, be careful. Watch out what you're doing.
Well, I think I think there's an issue as to how solid are the findings of this study. But even to accept it at face value, I think what they're addressing are those individuals who have inborn vulnerability and who are using excessive amounts of the drug. Across the board, increased cannabis use has not led to increased incidence of schizophrenia. You can see that in epidemiological studies. But for very vulnerable individuals who are perhaps on the threshold of major mental illness to begin with, the excessive use of whatever drug they might have access to could be a severe risk factor for aggravation of their underlying disease.
Well, you sound like the kind of doctor that a lot of people would like to have for their own physicians, because you are open-minded, I think, to new things. And there are a lot of them who close the door, Charles.
Well, thank you for the compliment. But certainly we do need to keep an open mind, particularly about, you know, such a highly politicized area as drug use.
Can these psychedelics, either one of you, hurt you if you don't know what you're doing?
Oh, of course, of course. There's no end of examples of individuals who've gotten into a lot of trouble, who were not attentive to set and setting, who took the compounds under adverse circumstance, who perhaps mixed it with other drugs or alcohol. Certainly, growing up in the 1960s, there was no lack of examples of individuals who fell off the side of the road. But but that being said, individuals who very, very careful and approach this use of these compounds with great respect and perhaps even trepidation, who have learned from the lessons of the past, and who ideally will seek an experience in a safe and sanctioned setting. With such individuals, the relative benefits may outweigh the relative risk.
Marilyn, I'm sure Edgar is a believer in remote viewing and areas like that. Do you ever see the day where psychedelics would be administered to people where they can do things like that, remote view, travel in their minds?
Well, at the Institute of Noetic Sciences is having a big conference in August, coming right up, 9th through 12th, at La Quinta in Palm Springs. And one of the things that we're doing is hosting a town hall meeting on transformation in healthcare and really visioning together about the future possibilities of medicine. The conference overall is about consciousness in action, so looking at a variety of different areas, and Dr. Grobe will be one of the presenters amongst, 30 other people that represent a variety of perspectives. But I really agree with what you said about, Charlie Grobe's being an example of the kind of physician all of us would love to have.
Oh, absolutely. He just seems open-minded, and he's willing to investigate and experiment. You have to do that.
Yeah, open-minded and very smart and discerning at the same time. So this town hall meeting, he'll participate in that as well as a number of other leaders. And really the goal of that particular session at this big conference is to dream together, like I was talking about the Achuar people dreaming together. Can we dream up a better model of medicine for 21st century living?
Now, when you say dream together, is this like the ancients did? Or are we doing it dream together in terms of our thought, collective thought, to put together a better plan?
Well, when we talk about the use of hallucinogens to vision, and we can think about our imagination, you don't need hallucinogens to stimulate the imagination. And when you bring a bunch of very smart people together, all of whom have an investment in the outcome, like we are all about to be, in one way or another, connected to the healthcare system of, you know, this country, it's important for all of us. So if we can enter a state of openness, and we're going to do some creative writing, and we're going to do some, I've got a graphic artist who's actually going to illustrate the emerging story that we do over this two-hour
period. All
right,
well, tell me a little bit more of that, Marilyn, when we come back, as we talk about the mind and the brain. It's an incredible thing to waste.